After me. An acre is the area of a rectangle whose length is 1 furlong and whose width is 1 cubit.
Yeah.
whose length is one furlong and whose width is one shade.
Well, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like the song? Mother, do you think they'll try to break my balls? Ooh, mother, should I build the wall?
We don't need no education, we don't need no thought control. And that was Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, and this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 68. Another Brick in the Wall, Part 1. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This show is being released on Friday, March 5th, 2010. My interview with John Taylor Gatto was recorded on February 23rd, 2010. I simply couldn't wait to share this interview with all of you, and it's just too important, so I have to share. And so I'm releasing it 3 days early. It's like Christmas in spring, but without the mushrooms. Today we're going to learn the significance behind Pink Floyd's song Another Brick in the Wall Part 2, and actually Roger Waters wrote that song specifically for today's interview, though he doesn't know it yet. We asked some important questions. Is there a relationship between eugenics, mind control, and compulsory education? Is compulsory education good for anyone, and what are the negative effects of our modern education system? Where did our education system originate, and by whom? What's happened to our educational system since the 1800s? Has there been an intentional effort by the elites and government to dumb us down? What do compulsory education and Pavlov's dogs have in common? Are children better off working or being in school? To answer these questions, we first have to reach the foundation of our education system. Continuing our education on the Trivium Method, this is one of the most important and powerful interviews to date, and my guest for this week and next is John Taylor Gatto, probably the most famous school teacher in the world, and he was New York State's Teacher of the Year when he quit on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal in 1991. John Taylor Gatto climaxed his teaching career as New York State Teacher of the Year after being named New York City Teacher of the Year on 3 occasions. He quit teaching on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal in 1991 while still New York State Teacher of the Year, claiming that he was no longer willing to hurt children. Later that year, he was the subject of a show at Carnegie Hall called An Evening with John Taylor Gatto, which launched a career of public speaking in the area of school reform, which has taken Gatto over 1.5 miles in all 50 states and 7 foreign countries. In 1992, he was named Secretary of Education in the Libertarian Party's shadow cabinet, and he has been included in Who's Who in America from 1996 on. In 1997, he was given the Alexis de Coqueville Award for his contributions to the cause of liberty and was named to the Board of Advisors of the National TV Turnoff Week. His books include Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, 1992, The Exhausted School, 1993, A Different Kind of Teacher, 2000, and Underground History of American Education, 2001, and his most recent book is Weapons of Mass Instruction. You can go to his website at www.johntaylorgatto.com. And since I've done about 67 intros before today's show that go into where you can buy books and things like that and how to support the Gnostic Media podcast, I'm going to skip all the bullshit today and get straight into our education with John Taylor Gatto. What you're about to hear will tear your heart out. You're about to see how the entire mind control system was put into place and how it works. Gnostic Media is not responsible for your anger, but we do encourage you to take immediate action by taking an active role in your community, PTA organizations, and by all means, share this information with everyone you know, especially parents of school children. The future depends on it. And if you have your children in compulsory education, go and get them out right now and begin homeschooling today. Because if you want to beat the New World Order and these psychotic elitists, it's the only way. And really, what are you waiting for? This is an MP3. Take it with you, and you'll need it to share it with them anyway. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. If you would like to visit the Gnostic Media website, go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. You can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. John, welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast. How are you today?
I'm as good as being 75 allows me to be, so pretty much okay.
Well, I suppose that's a good age to be at. That means you've got lots of wisdom. Is that correct?
No comment. I'll let your listeners decide.
All right. Well, you know, I've read a couple of your books, and I would have to say that it shines in your work. Why don't you start out by telling us, who is John Taylor Gatto?
Okay. I was born in western Pennsylvania in a small coal mining, steelworking town about 40 miles from Pittsburgh. The name is Monongahela, and it was quite an interesting place to grow up during World War II. The sky was always red or black, red with flames at night and black with soot in the day. The people were genuinely a melting pot community. The population was 4,400, and there were 48 different religious denominations in town, which I only as an old fellow have come to see made a lot of nervous times for ministers, etc. Anyway, the town taught me independence, self-reliance, critical thinking, so many things just came from being in a genuine community where people looked out for one another in a kind of a tough-minded way. When I came to New York City and it had the reputation of being a melting pot, and I quickly saw that everyone in the city was ghettoized pretty strictly, and the schools ghettoized them further, I was a little bit taken aback, and after a while I became very angry about it, because I had grown through my teen years in a real community. I don't know how many of those are left in the United States. So I went to two Ivy League colleges, first Cornell and then Columbia. And as I told an audience at Geneva College in Western Pennsylvania a few days ago, I cannot remember a single thing I learned very expensively at those two colleges. And when I came out of college, I went into the advertising business as a copywriter. But it seemed to be, Well, dull is the right word. I said, I can't believe, now I'm 22 or whatever. I said, I can't believe people do this all their life. And they sit around arguing about adjectives or adverbs. So my roommate was, a chef who opened a restaurant. He also had a teaching degree without a photo ID on it. And he threw it into the drawer after teaching one day, and he said, you'd have to be a lunatic to make your money that way. Then he went to the Virgin Islands and opened a swell restaurant called the Club Comanche. And when I was in between advertising jobs, it occurred to me that I could take his license and substitute teach, which I did, and that changed my life, because the first or second assignment I got up in Harlem was teaching Spanish classes, and I probably have 90 words of Spanish, but I can tell time. So I asked the classes as they came in whether they knew how to tell time. None did, and I was able to fill 40 minutes, although I had to stretch things, then it takes about 15, teaching them how to tell time. The third class I met that day brought with it the principal, a white lady with a face that had turned dark purple. She was so angry. She took me out in the hall and asked what I was doing. I said, I'm teaching them how to tell time. She said, that is the entire curriculum for the month of June. How will I explain this to the regular teacher when she came back? And I didn't think I heard correctly. I said, no, it takes 15 minutes to tell time. It can't be the whole curriculum for the month of June. Her last words to me were, you will never be hired at this school again, which sort of upset me a little, but since there were hundreds and hundreds of schools and they all needed substitutes, it didn't put me off my feed. And the next school I went to, I was given remedial reading for, I think, 9-year-olds. And before the class started, a little girl named Milagros came up to me and said, I don't belong in this class. I can read anything. And I said, now, dear. I said, this is all done scientifically, etc., etc. Well, Milagros grabs a huge book from the teacher's desk, a readings, and she said, open it anywhere and I'll show you. So I opened it at random to The Devil and Daniel Webster, a 19th century story written in 200 word long sentences with a really obscure vocabulary, and she did. She read it flawlessly. So I said, well, we make mistakes too, Milagros. I'll speak to the principal at lunch hour and we'll get you moved. But when I spoke to the principal at lunch hour, her face turned that deep shade of purple, and she said, I am not used to taking advice from substitute teachers. And furthermore, Mr. Gatto, you are extremely innocent. These children will memorize a story to make it appear that they can read. So, good God. Of course, I opened the book at random, so she would have had to memorize the entire reader. But nevertheless, even memorizing The Devil and Daniel Webster was far beyond anything I personally could have done. So anyway, the lady said she'd come in after school and show me. And then she said, and you will never be hired in this school again. So she comes in after school. Milagros can read anything, held upside down. The woman gets angrier and angrier instead of delighted and repeats, you will never be. She said, Milagros, you will be moved on Monday. You can go now. And then when Lagos was gone, she said, you will never be hired again. Well, that was the beginning of 30 years in the classroom. I said to my wife, I'm just going to teach long enough to see how far I can push these kids who are supposed to be terminally stupid, you know. And the truth is, after 30 years, I never reached the bottom of that well. So, when the New York State Teacher of the Year competition came along, somebody put my name up because I had evolved a kind of classroom program that didn't take place in the classroom. I used all New York City as a text. I pitched the lessons for 13-year-olds on exactly the level that I had learned at Cornell and Columbia, and my kids began winning enormous strings of prizes reserved for students in special high schools, etc. So the first time my name went up, I was named first runner-up state teacher of the year, but I was also named New York City teacher of the year. And the second time my name went up, I was named New York State teacher of the year. Well, the phone rang, and I began to get invitations around the country, and people flew in to look at my class, which didn't make me very happy because I had to hide what I was actually doing. So finally, I resigned on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal, saying I wasn't prepared to hurt children anymore, and the phone rang, and it was the vice president, not the president, but I did go to the White House, and I spoke before the vice president, then in the old Senate office building.
Which vice president was that?
That was the guy who couldn't spell potato. Nice fellow.
Dan, good old Dan Quayle.
It was Dan Quayle. And then I spoke before the New American Schools Committee in the old Senate office building, came back to New York, and got a call from NASA Goddard Space Center. This is really bringing a certain smile to my lips. I said, are you sure you have the right number? I spent my life talking to 13-year-olds. Well, they wanted me to come back to Washington, to Beltsville, and speak before the engineering colloquium. So when I was absolutely certain they wanted me to come down, I went down, spoke to the engineering colloquium, got back to New York City, and there was an invitation from, let me see, it was from the Colorado Librarians Association. There was also one from the Fluid Controls Institute of Philadelphia. By this time, I was having a good old time. My wife and I had decided we have a 125-acre farm in upstate New York, and we were going to be garlic farmers. But I said, you know, these will peter out when the Wall Street Journal article does, and that was 30 years ago. Or no, it was 20 years ago, and last year I was the keynote speaker for the South Korean National Education Convention in 10 Australian cities for the first national homeschooling convention in Australia. I consulted with the Colombian government in Bogota and almost got kidnapped. and I spoke in Budapest, Hungary, Amsterdam, Holland, and twice in London, as well as in all the American states. So you can see that at 75, I don't have all that much time left to be a garlic farmer, but I still hope.
Well, that's great. How did you almost get kidnapped in Colombia?
Well, I went there with some big shot from the Cato Institute. Went down there, and they put us up at the International Hotel, which is a really fine place down there, and surrounded by mountains. I mean, Colombia is a lovely country. My Cato Institute companion decided to go out and walk around town, and I remember saying to Marshall, there has to be a reason why the guards in front of the hotel are carrying submachine guns. That's very impressive, I must tell you.
That must have been back during the revolution days.
As I understand it, I would hardly represent myself as an expert on Colombia, but it's a kind of cash occupation to kidnap people. So,
yeah, well, I know it used to be a lot worse back in the 80s and 90s, but I think it's pretty mellow and considered a favorite.
Well, that would be good, because it's a country well worth going to. Anyway, my Cato partner strayed a few blocks away from the hotel, and I went to find him. He said he was just going to look at the market down the street. So when I got there, he was clearly being surrounded. It wasn't right up against his body, but you could see that a cordon had been made around poor Marshall. And fortunately, somebody from the hotel, probably because this fellow was well known, came with a guard after us. And when they pulled us both away and got us back to the hotel, he said they were going to kidnap you. So I got a good laugh out of that, too, because I'm not worth a sou.
Yeah, you know, Colombia today is actually a favorite tourist destination, but there was a while there that it was pretty bad down there.
Well, it deserves to be. The people are wonderful. The food is excellent, and the country itself is quite lovely.
Yeah, I've been down to South America. I haven't been into Colombia specifically, but I've spent some time down there. Would you like to talk about the old schoolhouses?
Sure. What developed American power, inventiveness, and wealth was a kind of crazy quilt of schooling offerings, but I'll go to the more formal ones in one- and two-room schoolhouses, which would contain between 40 and 90 kids, since it was impossible, especially in the independent air of colonial America and early federal America, to actually teach 90 kids. They were broken up into groups, and those groups were half taught by accomplished students, not A students, but students accomplished in leadership and with a pretty good understanding of what the business to be learned was. Because of this heavy student participation, and I would say also the shortness of the term of confinement, it hardly ever went beyond 2.5 months, and the average amount of time per day was 2 hours. I mean, some places like Boston, it was longer than that, but not much longer. So as a consequence, what you were talking to me about Linux, a kind of open source learning where everyone was a potential teacher, and you know, any area of interest potentially could connect you with a whole lot of the learnings that would help you navigate the society. Because of that, I believe that the curriculum, the formal curriculum written down in the book, was easily superseded by a kind of practical curriculum, and I'll be specific about this. Whatever seemed to be taught, here are some of the things that were at the center of the curriculum. And I'm even going to sidestep the trivium and quadrivium, which are excellent ways to organize. But I'm going to sidestep those and say that probably the single distinguishing characteristic of an excellent mind, a trained mind, is the ability to concentrate and shut out everything else. In fact, there probably are no theories of intelligence that don't move concentration to the number one position as the most reliable evidence that you're dealing with a strong mind. Well, think of the schooling that exists now. The bells ring, or the horns or the buzzers, every 42 minutes. But in the meantime, it takes 10 minutes for all the kids to string into class because there are no penalties, nor do they understand what they're costing themselves. There are infinite numbers of loudspeaker announcements, messengers pounding on the door. I mean, our schools are a chaos of broken time. Now step back a little bit farther and say, if somebody wanted to be certain that concentration didn't develop across a wide front in students, they would invent the kind of schooling that we have. Okay. The next thing I think that no one would disagree about is that the skills of associating with all kinds of people to move into a leadership association or a follower association or to an egalitarian association, those skills are priceless. Priceless. They don't tend to develop in an environment where you're not supposed to talk, you know, and you're not supposed to talk to anyone except the authority in front of the class. I could really beat this to death, but if you just wanted to create a skillful association and someone skilled at concentration, you would not go about it the way we're doing it. Now let me move into a third area, which most people would put first, probably, I would guess. The ability to express yourself verbally and behaviorally in all kinds of situations is just a sine qua non of opportunity. There's so many ways you can step on someone's toes or make yourself seem unacceptable to a group that if we only taught expression and left everything else up to the kids, we would be doing them a grand favor. So now we have concentration, association, expression, none of which or priorities, even in the gifted and talented programs. Then let me add what the early Americans may well have put at the top, and that was raw experience. You only need to read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography to see that by the age of 11, he probably had, certainly by the age of 13, he had more experience than the average person who grows up and drops dead in New York City. And he was hungry, and so were all of the people he associated with. He was hungry to get raw experience, even though he came from a family. They weren't poor, but they had no money. There were 17 kids. He crossed the Atlantic twice all by himself. I mean, we're talking about the 18th century, where it was, as they say, a trip. He put himself through a curriculum, and so did his friends. After working 60 hours a week, that Yale or Harvard would not dream of asking their undergraduates to match. So we have been stupendously dumbed down. Now I've touched four bases: concentration, association, expression, experience. We could go a little bit farther, but I think that's enough for a first chapter of reforming, when I say your own practice, I mean anyone listening who has kids, whether they're in school or whether they're being homeschooled.
What is the purpose of modern education?
Well, if you put yourself through a short course in the great philosophers of Western history, it's probably true the great philosophers of Eastern history too, but I'm much more knowledgeable about our part of the world, you would find that from Plato onwards, without exception, nobody believed that what you and I call education could possibly be true for most of the population, because they were hopelessly trapped in however they were born. You could condition habits, and you could condition attitudes, so you might get the simulation of a learned person, but as Plato, well, we're all familiar, Plato divides people into gold, silver, bronze, and lead, I believe, although it's about 40 years since I've read it. You don't transmute those metals. You're stuck with them, and the base metals are a threat to the precious metals. Now move up quite a way through history to the so-called, move up to John Calvin, who was a magnificently learned attorney before he became the king Protestant theologian. And read Institutes of the Christian Religion, which will certainly give anyone who reads it a headache, but not because Calvin wastes words. He has a trained lawyer's mind. He says that salvation is already decided before you're born. About one person out of every 20 has been selected for salvation. The people so selected cannot commit an act so heinous, mass murder, forget it. They were called justified sinners. They were going to heaven regardless of what they did. But everybody else, let's say 95% of the population, was doomed whatever they did. So forget the old Catholic idea of good works and you earn your way to heaven. There was no way to get there. Now, what Calvin proposed, since 19-1 odds are pretty heavy odds to deal with if you happen to be saved, he constructs brilliantly a system of mass forced education. Forced is the important word, in which the denizens of the schools are so confused by half-truths and mal-teaching that they're never going to be a serious problem to the saved again. Let's jump a few hundred years forward in history to the so-called liberal philosopher Spinoza in Holland, taught everywhere, as this grand liberal and champion of freedom. There's the truth there, but it's only true for one person out of 20. What Spinoza wrote, and I'll give you the actual reference because I have a feeling you'll have some scholarly listeners, readers. What Spinoza said was that the vast majority of the human race is murderously irrational. There's no cure for it, just as there's no cure for being born made of lead, or no cure being born already doomed. And Calvin said, there's no cure for this irrationality. And so to protect the good stuff, what has to be done is a system of universal forced schooling set up, which deliberately pumps the mind full of half-truths and outright errors, deprives the people of skill by teaching subjects rather than skills. I mean, concentration, association, expression are skills, but now we could turn that into English. What does that mean? You know, language arts. What does it mean? What does social studies mean? Well, it doesn't mean anything. It means whatever the particular instructor wants it to mean. So anyway, the big-time philosopher, though, who's after Spinoza, is the guy who inherits Immanuel Kant's chair at the University of Berlin. It's a fellow named Johann Fichte, spelled F-I-C-H-T-E. And after Napoleon, with his amateur army, wipes out the Prussian army at the Battle of Jena in 1806, which takes place right under Immanuel Kant's window, you know, right around the precincts of the University of Berlin, Fichte makes public demands on the King of Prussia. He says, we got wiped out this way, and after all, our economy's based on warfare, so that's not a good advertising. He said, we lost because sergeants thought for themselves and lieutenants thought for themselves. He demanded that the King of Prussia institute a system of forced schooling, which would begin in early childhood and last until any scrap of independent critical thinking is wiped out. And according to Fichte, and of course Spinoza said exactly the same thing, the imagination is the great enemy of the best people. Because if this mass that's hopeless has an imagination left alive, it can surprise their betters. So he said, you got to wipe out the imagination. Well, now that sounds like a pretty big bill of goods, but it's not a big bill of goods if you put somebody in a rigorous, time-constrained environment, you deprive them of any other source of wisdom except the official state teaching. You can do quite a number on the imagination. And furthermore, if you tell them what they're supposed to imagine. So the popular expression is, if you don't teach them to connect the dots for themselves, but simply to memorize what they're told to memorize. And if they're going to have chains of analyses, those are to be memorized too. It doesn't really take very long before the mind can't do this for itself. In the current issue of The Atlantic, it used to be called The Atlantic Monthly, there's an article about what the effect of prolonged joblessness is going to be on this country. And the Atlantic writer predicts joblessness will last as far into the future as we can see, that there'll be temporary recoveries, but there'll be illusions. In the course of doing that, and this is the current issue of Atlantic, March 10th, I believe is the cover date, the fellow says that the highly structured school childhoods that the young adults have come out of right now have temperamentally unprepared them for the circumstances of the moment, that the graduates dislike the idea of work, and about one-third of them don't even try to engage the jobs market. And these are qualities directly quoted from that article. When he's profiling what these new young men and women are like, he says they blame others for their own difficulties. They expect someone else to fix any problems they encounter. They lack independence, entrepreneurialism, leadership skills, problem-solving ability, and they need almost constant direction. We're not talking about the dunces. We're talking about the best who come out of these programs. They flounder without precise guidelines. That's what forced schooling teaches. You wait for someone else to tell you what to do. And yet in the world you and I have been plunged in, what it demands is adaptability, perseverance, enterprise, and humility, not self-esteem. Our recent graduates expect rewards without exchanging successful performance for them. What we desperately need is children willing to give value back to the community, young people rooted in the work that a coherent society needs them to do. And if you say, well, what work is that? I urge your listeners to pick up the 100-page-long autobiography of Benjamin Franklin and prepare, if you haven't read it before, to have your hair stand up straight on your head. We've created a mass of parasitic young people who essentially can't do anything. And more than that, they don't want to do anything. They want to be cared for. We have a leadership that collapses the economy and pays themselves $100 million bonuses a year. I mean, we're in a much deeper mess, I think, than even the newspapers acknowledge. It's not temporary at all.
I think the newspapers are actually behind in helping to promote this whole system. You know, they certainly aren't doing investigative quality journalism anymore. You have to go to the internet and places like that to get good independent journalism these days.
Yes, yes, I would agree with you. Of course, the newspapers and the magazines are owned by the people who own the economy, but I'll pass that by.
All right. Do genetics and eugenics play into the organizational structure of the modern school system?
Hugely. The biggest culprit, I named Spinoza and Calvin and Fichte and Plato. By far, the biggest culprit is Charles Darwin. By far, the innocent man of wealth who travels on the Beagle and publishes a book in 1859 called Origin of Species. And I want your listeners to listen hard enough to hear, I'm not talking about the theory of evolution. I'm talking about Darwin's conclusion 12 years after he wrote Origin of Species. The book is the descent of man. It will be in every library in the United States. That's how carefully it's put out there, you know, so that the Inner Circle Club can renew their faith in what they're doing. What he says in Descent of Man is that the overwhelming mass of the human race, including all the Irish, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit Irish, but the audiences who want to be skeptical, I urge them to go to Descent of Man and read what Darwin says about the Irish. If these lower forms of life, which are about 95% of the people on Earth, including, as I said, all the Irish, if they crossbreed with the good stuff, Darwin said evolution would march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. In other words, if you're a responsible person of means, then what you have to do is join in a kind of gentleman's agreement to separate the good breeding stock from the bad breeding stock, which is, after all, 95% of the population, and then turn that 95% against one another. Because just as Calvin discovered, you know, 19 to 1 odds are bad odds. There aren't enough of the good people to keep the bad people down. They have to be trained to keep themselves down. And far and away, the best way to do that is what Julius Caesar discovered when he was conquering Gaul. You set your enemies against themselves in large ways and small ways. You underwrite and maintain infinite numbers of competitions so they come to see one another as their enemies, as someone blocking their path to opportunity. I mean, we start this in first grade, so that if some of your listeners say, is he going to attack competition? No, in a moment I'm going to argue that one form of competition is utterly essential to a good life. But first let me take the pop quizzes and prelims and standardized tests and final exams, midterm exams. What we're dealing with here is a way to keep the ordinary population from bonding together in common interest. You'll recall that in the standard biography of Horace Mann by Messerly is the writer's name. Messerly notes that there's a curious entry in Horace Mann's diary that he made while he was watching a parade of working men in Boston in 1843. Mann jots down this thought: we must find a way to break the bond of association among working men. What could that possibly mean? Why must we find a way to do that? Well, I won't pursue that any further because I'll get back to the main theme here. Whenever the society, and I mean its managers, need people to learn something, they remove the competitive part entirely. And now I will set out to prove that to you. Our kind of commercial society, spread out over, you know, millions of square miles, cannot exist unless virtually everybody can drive. Obviously, buying cars and maintaining them is also a big chunk of the whole economy. But you've got to have everybody drive, you know, 10 miles to get a pack of cigarettes, whatever. As a consequence, nobody fails the driving test. Yes, you know, people who failed it twice. Everybody always gets their driver's license. And let me prove this a little bit further. We're not talking about hiring an A student over a B student to be a clerk in an office. We're talking about life and death. If anybody actually thought that measuring the degrees of distinction in driving, which, as I said, life and death, mattered, then every automobile would have an electronic display saying this driver is C+. Why shouldn't you have a right to know that information? Well, once again, I'm not going to beat that to death. The same thing's true about frontline soldiers. When I was in basic training in San Antonio, Texas, you couldn't get through basic training unless blindfolded. You could take a rifle apart and put it back together again. Well, you know, it had 57 little parts, some of them really little. Blindfolded, you dropped one. But I don't know anybody who was recycled through basic training. I imagine a tiny handful must have been, but I'm sure they passed it the second time through, because everyone on a rifle line has to be able to keep their rifle functioning, and at night too, when you can't see, and everyone does. Why don't they say, this is an A+ assembly? He did that in 90 seconds. And here's a failure. He did it in 3.5 minutes. Well, once again, my original premise is if the society or the leadership of the society requires that everybody knows something, even something difficult and dangerous like highway driving or assembling a rifle in combat situation, they do learn it. You know, somebody younger than me, he may have that idea and write a book about it. I mean, it's a rich field of exploration.
You mentioned the Prussian education system earlier. Would you care to provide more detail about
that?
Sure.
The idea was to break the imagination, break association with other people so they couldn't band together and mutiny in the battlefield. Excuse me. All of this was drawn, by the way, from observations on the battlefield at Jena, where this highly trained military force of Prussia was just wiped out by these amateurs of Napoleon. Remember, Napoleon said that the lowest common soldier should have a field marshal's baton in his pack and be able to think like the field marshal. That wasn't the Prussian idea at all. They divided their schooling into three parts. There was the people's school called the Volksschule, or Volksschulen, which wiped out your imagination and filled your mind with nonsense so that you were like a child and very obedient. Then there was the Realschulen, the real schools. Those were to train the assistants of the leaders. Those were to train the doctors, the lawyers, the architects, the people who served the managerial classes. And they were to learn how to specialize. They could learn the people's schools. You never did anything except memorizing facts and obeying orders. But the real schools, you got a chance to think in context. But only in a specialty, you know. So that created the specialists, and the idea spread all around the world from Prussia. But finally, there were the academy schools. And the funny thing is, if you read about how those were organized internally, And what I'd recommend for someone starting out is to read von Humboldt's, I forget the title, but it deals with how you fashion a school that creates leadership, independent thought, all those good things. And it's just a marvelous formulation. It's a couple of hundred years old. Von Humboldt's the guy they named the current in the ocean after. And he was widely considered to be the smartest, most accomplished man in the world. So the academy schools taught, for example, that war was play, and that you could get prodigies of value out of your soldiers as long as the officers didn't take the rules seriously. So the American Army in World War II had 60,000 pages of rules, but the Prussian Army encouraged its unit commanders to adapt to the circumstances in front of them on the spot, to think for themselves. As a consequence, and I'm quoting the famous Israeli military historian, John, don't let your memory fail you now. Anyway, I'm quoting an Israeli military historian who said that even in the last days of the war, when the Germans were outnumbered everywhere and had no equipment to speak of or ammunition, that they inflicted four times more casualties on the forces that they encountered, even when outnumbered 4-1, than they took themselves. And it's because everyone was trained to adapt to circumstances. Whereas in the American Army, the British Army, if you screwed up and there was a rule showing that you disobeyed it, I mean, you were court-martial meat. I mean, all these fascinating clues are everywhere once you free your mind from the rules and allow yourself some latitude to interpret the rules for yourself or to amend them for yourself. These are the people who go furthest. I guess most people listening would think it would be horrible if I said, which I'm going to say, that one of the worst punishments ever delivered to young people were the child labor laws. One of the worst punishments. Most people never recover from not encountering the world of work seriously.
And that's the exact opposite of what everybody actually thinks. When you hear of kids working, everybody says, oh, well, that's just horrible in those slave drivers. But what you're saying is that giving children work actually builds smarter, better, stronger society.
Just what we knew for almost all our history. We pick up Warren Buffett's autobiography, and you'll discover that Warren Buffett had a profitable business for himself at the age of 6. And by the age of 13, he had five, he didn't come from a wealthy family, he had five profitable businesses for himself, in none of which did he do the work. He started the business, saw how it worked best, then he hired other kids to do it for him. When he applied to the Wharton School of Business at the age of 18, that's back, I think, in 1939, but don't hold me to the date, he had the modern equivalent of $100,000 in the bank. Not bad for an 18-year-old who didn't inherit anything. And what he did, everything he did, added value to the community around him. And furthermore, as you read the autobiography, you say why someone could do all those things today, because he did not preempt the entire market, but the tiniest fraction of the market there. And as soon as he had one going, he hired somebody to run it, and he started another one. look at who's the guy just built a rocket ship and sold all the seats for $250,000? Branson. If you read Branson's autobiography, you know, I think Branson's the 24th wealthiest man in the world. But he grew up, his mother was an airline stewardess back in the days when that was dicey work. When he was 4 years old, create an image in your mind now of a four-year-old. His mother drove him miles from their London home, not the easiest city to get around in, and said, Richard, do you think you could find your way home alone from here? And he said he thought he could. She pulled the car over and said, well, get out then and do so. And she went home. In his autobiography, he says, this was far and away the educational experience of his life. He dropped out of high school, never went to college, and by 19, he was a millionaire, and not with the businesses he's now known for. Those came in, he's got about a dozen businesses operating. The inventor, or not the inventor, the creator of the Human Genome Project, the most prestigious scientific project in the world today. There are two of them. Francis Collins was homeschooled in a single-parent family on a remote sheep ranch in western Virginia. He had three brothers, and the only rule his mother applied was the four brothers had to agree what to study. There was no balanced diet, no nothing, except the four of them agreed, and they studied it as long as they felt like it. But nobody could leave until all four agreed they had worn that to death. That's one of the two creators of the Human Genome Project. The other one just published his autobiography. His name is Venter, Craig Venter. He was a C-minus, D-plus student who only graduated from junior high school because the teachers changed his marks. He was such a reprehensible human being. They didn't want him back for a double dip. They passed him along. And did he start at Harvard, Yale, or Princeton? No. He started at age 18 as a medical corpsman in Vietnam. How about that? So those two guys created the Genome Project, which every business in the world's lined up to get rich off of now. Ingvar Kamprad, the founder of IKEA, was declared, I think he was 9 years old, but he might have been 10, hopelessly dyslexic. In other words, it was just impossible for him to learn. So he dropped out of, I guess, junior high school, and he became a bicycle peddler of fish. If you would just create a picture in your mind, I can't think of a job more unrewarding.
Right. Part,
if you want to buy a fish. But he mastered it, and he added wooden matches and Christmas tree ornaments. And of course, 15 years later, there were these IKEAs all over the world. We go on and on and on and on. The number one patent holder in U.S. history with patent for the, you know, the telephone and the phonograph, Thomas Edison, was working as a gopher on a long-distance train in Michigan, 1,000 miles from his home in Edison, New Jersey, somewhere in New Jersey, when he was like 9 years old. And by the time he was 12, he set up a printing press. He found a broken printing press, repaired it in a boxcar on the train, and he was getting Civil War news off the train's telegraph before the newspapers had it. So at whistle stops, he was selling a broadsheet called the Grand Trunk Herald for like a dime or a quarter a copy when that was real money. And by the time he was 18, he had a nice fat stake and could set himself up in business. We have artificially extended childhood to such a gross extent now that an awful lot of our young people never recover from it. And the ones that do are always bringing up the rear. And yet we could cure this virtually overnight without spending a nickel. The kids need heavy experience in concentrating, and usually that's best on something of your own selection. If you've ever tried to pry a kid away from like a video game, or in my day, from a chess set, you know that they're perfectly capable of concentrating for long stretches of time until the habit of schools almost destroys that in most of us. Then we become antsy, you know, with a 1 minute ad. We want quarter minute ads or 5 second ads.
Sally, Dick, and Jane. John, do you hear me?
Yeah. Go right. Ahead.
Sally, Dick, and Jane.
Well, the Sally part came later. Dick and Jane, the textbook publishing industry is 55% of all the profit in publishing, and it's been that way since World War I. The textbooks are the creation of committees. Every member of the committee who counts, at least the voting majority of these committees, represents stakeholders in the community, in real estate, you know, in merchandising, in whatever. The Prussian program, let me call it that, is intended to make people manageable so that you can efficiently manage because you can predict what the people are thinking and what they'll do with their time. It wasn't very long before, from Darwin's first cousin, Francis Galton, mathematical formulae were available to predict, and it was part of the whole statistical package that emerged in the 19th century, to predict what people were going to buy. Market research, we call it now. Well, it was early on discovered that market research, which asks you to invest, you know, millions of dollars in something, was highly unreliable. I know that will come as a surprise to some of your prosperous readers who buy it. Was, I said. And there was a kind of a panic because the utopian future was going to be constructed out of market research. Then, if I say someone, I'm speaking metaphorically now, it was a lot of someones, came to the conclusion that you could rig the game. If you made the people predictable, if you standardized them, yes, just like the standardized test too, then these mathematical formula were very, very reliable. They didn't work all the time, but they came pretty darn close to working if you ask enough people. And so, probably in the decade before and the decade after World War I, the population was standardized, and we shot to the top of the world's economies in merchandising. You could predict in advance that people would mortgage their future, their children's future, to buy whatever you promoted often enough or correctly. And that kind of logic is unstoppable until ultimate efficiency is reached, until whatever you offer for sale, and this, of course, was the great, great breakthrough that took place right around the turn of the 20th century. Instead of being crippled by the old-fashioned law of supply and demand, it became known to the managerial classes that demand was quite easy to create. And there were a whole lot of specific tools you could create it with. You know, you could stick your product next to a pretty girl. You could have the King of England put a seal on it. You know, lots of ways to do it. And the more you spend on these promotions, almost invariably, the more you could sell. People didn't know whether they needed it or not. They knew just what teachers had taught them. Do what you're told. So we eroded away the critically analytical part of the ordinary mind. By ordinary, I don't mean it's not bright, but it's habit trained to defer to experts.
How do those books work specifically to...
Oh, well, this is just brilliant. Not my brilliance. It's the brilliance of the design. There's a wild card loose in all the libraries of the planet and all the used bookstores and stuff that the wisest, brightest people in the history of the world have left behind a printed legacy. So that no matter how you dumb down your population, if they could read well enough, they would eventually maybe find their way to Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, where he says that nothing you can buy is worth having, and nobody you can boss around with your power is worth associating with. Now, there's a dangerous idea, right? How are you going to prevent people from reading Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, since the best people want to have access to those books, too? Well, one way to do it is to discourage people by training them in such a simplistic manner in reading. I'll give you a very specific here, that they cannot read Latinate sentences. Latinate sentences put their meaning at the end of the sentence. Loose English sentences, common sentences, put their meaning at the beginning of the sentence. It's only to watch bright 13-year-olds, as I did for many years, say, "I can't read this," to realize how diabolical the conditioning is that habituates you to childish stuff, so that when you get stuff that really is vitamins and minerals, and furthermore is inherently very, very interesting, you say, "That's not for me, I can't read that." There, it doesn't take very long to pat children on the head. Look at what we do in kindergarten. An Australian kindergarten teacher came to me, so I don't want to claim the originality of this idea. And she said, "We spend the first week in kindergarten here teaching the kids the colors." She said, "I have never in 8 years teaching known a single kid who arrived at kindergarten who didn't already know the colors." So she said by week 5 or 6, when we teach the kids what they already know, they've already shut off to the value of, you know, the intellectual diet we're offering. I thought it was a brilliant inside. And of course, I saw it on in an older cohort than that. It's what the real difference between the best private universities and the best public universities is. The public universities condition their students to think in terms of, quote, getting a good job, close quote. The private universities teach getting an independent livelihood. A world of difference, right? In 1859, when Abraham Lincoln spoke to the Wisconsin Agricultural Association, he said that we would never end up in the mess that Britain and Germany are in, where the ordinary population is a proletariat. They're like slaves, you know, working for somebody else. He said in this country, mind you, it's 1859, 75% of the population has an independent livelihood, and the other 25%, except for a few ne'er-do-wells and deadbeats, are putting together a capital stake in order to have an independent livelihood. Well, Abe, you're rolling over your grave now, because independent livelihoods were put to death by institutional schooling that starts in kindergarten and tells you the point is, it's not even intellectual development. It's getting a good job. It seems to me, and of course I'm 75, that whether you're a well-paid slave or a poorly paid slave, you're a slave. Look at the slaves now being thrown out of work by the tens of thousands that will never find that work again. They will not find it. The economy may recover, but there's no room for them.
And, you know, what I find interesting, and down in South America, so many families and people have these small little businesses in their house or things that they do. But it seems to me that when the economy gets bad, it almost has a reverse effect that people become have more business-like intuition or more creativity, and that they actually start creating these small types of self-sustaining businesses. Have you seen that or considered that?
Oh, yeah. An awful lot of, well, I don't know, it's probably not a majority, but there's a substantial fraction of the executive class who is quite aware when they lose their position that nobody is going to want them again. I mean, almost independent of their track record, because you can always hire somebody almost as good for a third of the wages. This happens, by the way, to engineers regularly, that when you become a senior engineer, and including in the computer world, you know, when you're over 40 and you have some really good track record behind you, who the hell wants you? I mean, you're being paid 6-7 times what a trainee is. You have an uppity attitude as if you're owed decent treatment. I've not only spoken to dozens of engineers who lose their work in their 40s and never find work again. Bill Gates, at the very same time, he calls on the governors of America to send everybody in school to college. I mean, it's quite a good market for, hardware and software. Has quietly started in India and China training colleges, and he lobbies behind the scenes for the U.S. government to waive its rules, you know, with limitation on importing these people to take American jobs. I mean, he's quite the quisling.
Let's talk about Dr. Seuss and the Cat in the Hat.
Well, you're going to prompt me a little farther, because it's 75, my brain is partly ossified.
Well, in your book, you mentioned that the origins of the Dr. Seuss story were, they had basically come to him and said that they wanted to...
Oh, yeah, okay, you primed the pump enough. In the first 3 decades of the 20th century, textbook publishing in reading became an extremely attractive way to become filthy rich, because states like Texas or California or a few others would bulk buy, if you could politically get your reading text past the committee. I mean, these states would buy, you know, 500,000 copies of your book, and then next year you'd buy 500,000, and the year afterward you'd put a different cover on it. Then buy another. I mean, it'd go on forever. It was a money machine. However, what was at work at that time? Because obviously this could have gone in the direction of increasingly intellectual textbooks, but it went in just the opposite direction. Following the German model, the dumbing down isn't done all at once. It's an incremental procedure to where you reach, as Dr. Seuss came on the scene as a young man, and certainly not as a man intending to harm anybody, but he came across the scientifically controlled word list, you know, where instead of drawing on the 1.5 or 2 million words in the rich English language, I mean, you cut down the possible word use, I don't know, 1,500 or 2,000, probably, in special situations, a good deal less than that. So Seuss felt trapped, sort of, and he invented his really droll and delightful little rhyming presentations out of these controlled word lists. And almost certainly there's, if you get Seuss in the controlled word list, you're actually getting some benefit that has little to do with building your lexicon, but certainly rhythmically and emphases in other ways. But what the public needs to know is this was done under the camouflage, under the guise of the world wars, when the public's attention was concentrating on, you know, slap the Jap and all the rest of the stuff, and humble the Hun, because it'd be the First World War. These could be rushed through state legislatures, and naturally you'd cut key people in on it. And not cynically, remember, they're drawing on the wisdom of Charles Darwin and a number of other big names, saying that you may as well not waste any effort on these people, because they're, in Darwin's case, they're biologically permanently inferior, or in Calvin's they're spiritually inferior, or in Spinoza's they're psychologically inferior, or in Fichte's they're politically inferior, and the system can't work without political inferior. So there are solid rationales that you can use to salve your conscience when you're doing this. Look, you could stop 500 people at random on the streets of your town, and I'd drop dead if more than one or two had any idea what the term overproduction means. And yet, without knowing what overproduction means, you're missing one of the great justifications for dumbing down young America. Go back to colonial days. The ideal, and a lot of people approached the ideal. I guess not many ever got there, but the ideal was you produced your own shelter, your own clothing, your own food, your own entertainment, your own education, your own medical care. So to be a perfect producer was the ideal. Well, how on earth could a corporation survive if that attitude survived? The whole idea of a corporation, and I want to extend it beyond commerce into government. The whole idea of a corporation is the corporation will do for you. You just sit back and,
right,
and you know, buy it or accept it.
Well,
pardon me?
If I may, read the Dr. Seuss quote from your book, Underground History of American Education. This is quoting Dr. Seuss. I did it for a textbook house, and they sent me a word list. That was due to the Dewey Revolt in the 20s, in which they threw out phonics reading and went to word recognition as if you're reading a Chinese pictograph instead of blending sounds or different letters. I think killing phonics was one of the greatest causes of illiteracy in the country. Anyway,
it was the greatest cause, and the Prussians worked it out. The Prussians, being a little more rigorous than us, didn't have a whole word system. They started out with a whole paragraph system, so you memorized a paragraph, but that didn't work, so they went to a whole sentence system. Our whole word system is a pale competitor. It was meant deliberately to prevent people from being able to get into those forbidden books and maybe develop their intellect. Australia uses it today. Even the schools today that say they use phonics use some bastardized half measure. Let me tell you, when I went to school at age five years old, and my mother didn't have a high school diploma, and my father didn't have a college diploma, I could read fluently. Dick and Jane, hardly. I was reading, the last thing I read before I went to first grade with my mother was Matthew Arnold's epic of ancient Persia called Sohrab and Rustum. You'd have a hard time finding that today. So I got to first grade, and what I expected were the glories of intellect. Instead, I got talking choo-choos. You know, there are so many ways this thing is accomplished. I mean, it's a net that's hard to escape.
Here's the rest of Dr. Seuss's quote in your book. And he says, anyway, they had it all worked out that a healthy child at the age of four can only learn so many words in a week. So there were 223 words to use in this book. I read the list three times, and I almost went out of my head. I said, I'll read it once more, and if I can find two words that rhyme, that'll be the title of my book. I found cat and hat and said, the title of my book will be The Cat in the Hat.
Yes, yes, yes. So you're embedded, we're embedded, the parents of children who are listening to you, you're embedded in a house of mirrors. You know, nothing is what it seems to be. If our productive population couldn't be reduced to a consuming population, the rise of the corporations could not have taken place. And if we return to being a productive population now, that, you know, we wouldn't be a decade before you would see the economy radically transformed. The corporation, and I'm not speaking from a political perspective, you know, of left or right. The corporation must, for its health, have a clientele who are incomplete, radically incomplete, as a matter of fact. There's almost no degree of incompletion that's not tried to reach. Even the diet of people who eat ground up cows' noses and ears and hooves, cows slaughtered in South America because you don't have to follow the, you know, the humane rules that are built up here. Hamburgers that kill enormous numbers of people. I'm not making that up. The number one bestseller in the country for 2 years was Fast Food Nation.
Right.
And it stated categorically how many, 13 people per day die horribly. Their insides liquefied from, I'll indict Big Macs, but it's the whole mass of them, and 250 people a day are hospitalized. Well, how could that? How could the government allow that to happen? Because these businesses are the foundation of factory agriculture. They're the far and away the biggest clients for tomatoes, onions, lettuce, wheat, mustard, ketchup, mayonnaise. On and on. And the Big Gulp, I don't know if they're out in California, the Big Gulp, which I think is 64 right. ounces of pop, and it has 48 teaspoons of sugar in it, is a guarantee that the medical profession will have unlimited diabetes amputations to perform.
Oh, for sure. And not only that, but they're using corn syrup, which is far worse than sugar. You know, and
I think your word. In fact, I know that to be true.
Right.
But sugar's bad enough.
It is. Yeah. But, you know, there's a couple of great documentaries out there on this. One is called King Corn and another one, Food Inc., that also covers the whole meat industry and how awful it is in this country. But, you know, having been down to South America 6 months ago, I've got to say that the meat quality standards down there are far higher than in the United States.
Here's the problem. The meat standards down there are not the meat standards for the slaughterhouses that are exclusively contracted to serve Burger King and McDonald's.
Oh,
Burger,
I see, right. Yeah,
the description in Fast Food Nation is essentially the Harvard, and I'm indicting Harvard the same way I'm indicting McDonald's. It's the whole pack of them. The business school figured out that humane slaughter was very expensive. That what you could do is simply put 100 animals in a room and club them to death with mallets. And, of course, what that does is it drives fecal matter through the meat. However, what they figured out was if you heat the meat to a certain temperature and hold it at that temperature for the right number of seconds, all the little poop bacilli will be killed, and no one has to be the wiser that they're eating poop burgers. Well, that probably would work to save billions of dollars. There's one flaw in the ointment. When you hire kids at minimum wage to perform these crucial operations, they're not always the most scrupulous about reaching that temperature and holding it long enough. As a consequence, we have 13 people a day dead and 250 people a day hospitalized. Why don't you hear about that? Well, the people who do that are intermarried with the people who own the newspapers, the TV stations. The government certainly doesn't want the key to the treasury and factory agriculture thrown away. That's why I say you're living in a hall of mirrors where nothing's what it seems to be. So the way out will not come through the ballot box, because nobody gets on the ballot for all practical purposes. The people who get on the ballot are the same people. Look at their campaign contributors. Look at their family associations. If I hear the term right or left one more time, I think I'll shoot somebody dead. There is no left in this country, and there's no right in the
exactly.
country. Oh, there may be on the lunatic fringe. I don't know. But they're all the same. They're homogenous.
Exactly.
They are textbook 19th century liberals, and the word has migrated in its meaning. What the word liberal meant was you're liberated from any of the restrictions on your behavior that are put on by religion or by tradition or by family ties or by decency. You're liberated from that. You're liberated from owing anything
you're free.
To your nation. The two Bush presidencies were textbook liberal. You know, as I say, when I heard the word conservative used, I said, Orwell is smiling in his grave. Newspeak is alive and well.
Oh, for sure. Well, you know, John, that's interesting that you bring this up, because I've actually written two articles, one on the definition of liberal and the other on the definition of conservative. And I published...
Don't mail me tear sheets. I'll read them with great interest.
I'll do that. I will. All right. Let's go into some of the bad guys. Let's talk about J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, Carnegie, those kind of fellas.
Okay. Let us start with Horace Mann, because he's the patsy and the fall guy. Mann grew up on a farm, and the father had died, and so Mann made straw hats, and he never wanted to see a straw hat again to keep him and his mom alive. But he married well. He married the president of Brown University's daughter, and although he had no interest whatsoever in schools, this is rich, he was approached by wealthy families, railroading families, which was the big corporation of the day, and told that if he could succeed in getting compulsory school laws passed, that he would be given Daniel Webster's seat in Congress. So he was a good speaker, and he was in the state legislature. He set out on a 10-year quest to bring compulsion schooling out of Prussia into the United States, and he succeeded. I believe the year was 1852, but I'm telling you, he had no interest in schools at all, but he was a practical politician and an ambitious straw hat maker. So Mann immediately caught on that what he said, or what mothers and fathers said, really didn't amount to a hill of beans. It was the great industrialists who were shaping the United States. And if you didn't have an alliance with those people, your personal ambition wasn't going to go very far. So Mann did what he was ordered to do, and then they screwed him. You and I might not think he'd been screwed, but he was exiled out of the civilized world to Western Ohio or Central Western Ohio, where a utopian colony was being converted into a college called Antioch. Now, it's got a pretty good rep, at least it did when I was in college. But and yet, in those days, it was just so far off the beaten track that it was like a pension. So man died a very bitter man, because when they had used him, they had no more use for him. Now what we were left with was the American tradition of tremendous independence and self-reliance, which was not so easy to deal with. In Massachusetts it was, in New York it was, in the Tidewater. But as soon as you went inland, here were people used to producing everything for themselves or exchanging with their neighbors. Here was this tight, flinty-eyed community of competent people. So you had to begin cutting into that. And that was done by a combination of bribes from the federal government, legislation that threw advantages to people who played ball, and so on. And what was the point of this great transformation? It was that Carnegie, Rockefeller, Astor, Vanderbilt, and maybe a dozen or two dozen other major names.
Like J.P. Morgan, et cetera.
Morgan was he was the banker. Morgan was the leading Episcopalian layman on planet Earth. And why that's important is the State Church of England says in its homily of obedience that God has put us all in our place. It's sort of like Plato, and if you try to get out of your place, you're insulting God. Remember, you have to have a justification to explain to your children so you can live with yourself while you're screwing your neighbors. So Morgan was the only one of those people, by the way, who had had the benefit of at least a partial Prussian education. He had had a year over there, so people came back from Prussia imbued with this idea that people were only machinery, and that if you found the right algorithms, you know, you could make the machinery work efficiently. So Morgan, who had eyes like an approaching express train, I think they were described once. Yes, he was part of the inner circle. And each one of these inner circle people, Morgan included, founded a private boarding school to protect the good breeding stock. Morgan's was Kent, which I think is up in Connecticut. Hotchkiss, who invented the machine gun, was Hotchkiss. And each one of these guys had their own boarding school. The Peabody family, I think, did Groton, which gave us Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Meanwhile, what they wanted was the American population converted from people who wanted an independent livelihood into people who wanted a good job. That was a hard sell, but not if you took their children, you know, 5 years old, and you kept them for 10 or 12 years. Then you created a breach between the parents who remembered what an independent livelihood really meant and the children who had these little prizes dangled in front of them. Good job prizes, a raise, a corner office, all the rest of that crap. And inside of, I would say, three generations, they broke the entrepreneurial spirit of the country. and replaced it with a corporate spirit, a corporate government. I mean, one of their great creations was to fool people into thinking that the government represents one interest and the capitalists represent another interest. That is quite untrue. Capitalism could not survive without a gigantic government. The government is the buffer, the flywheel. It represents the people, right? Well, you notice that the current representative of the people quickly passed, I don't know, what was it, $1 trillion to the same bankers who had ruined the country?
Right.
I mean, we are so brainwashed and conditioned. I can't listen to the so-called right-wing talk show hosts anymore because they are so innocent. They are so stupid. They're so brainwashed. They do the work that otherwise
I couldn't agree more. And of course, somebody up on high is putting those guys in those positions, like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and a number of others.
Oh, they're, of course.
They're putting them in those positions because they beckon to the stupidity of the average American that's been brainwashed.
Well, they're riding aggressively on a foundation that's been carefully built for over 100 years now that, well, we would be gratified if government got smaller, because they bulk our efficiency in business. Well, the first Bush presidency, that conservative, tripled the size of government. I mean, these are black and white figures, and the second guy, because he obviously was a stupid man, only doubled the size of government, you know.
Right.
But even I was optimistic that someone who spoke so beautifully, who so obviously had been trained in rhetoric, which has been cut out of the public school diet. Expression is something forbidden to.
You talking about Clinton or Obama?
I'm talking about Obama. You know, I said, you know, there still is a glimmering of hope.
Right.
When his first act in office was to turn the treasury over to the bankers who had ruined us.
Right.
If we make 10 million new jobs, we will only be back at 5% unemployment. When I was a boy during the Second World War, 5% unemployment was considered the revolutionary tipping point. Beyond that, so many people would be angry and disaffected that you'd start getting stamps stolen out of the office drawer and a million other acts of sabotage taking place. Now we say it's 10%. Read the Atlantic Monthly. It's 17.5%.
Right.
The Atlantic Monthly doesn't have a reputation. That's a radical journal. Oh, my, my. So the Hall of Mirrors again. Nothing is what it seems to be. You know.
Yeah, oh, I do, and I'm glad you mentioned so many of those points, because these are all things that we've been covering on my show in great depth lately.
They couldn't go down the Bush Avenue any longer and push this project forward, because the project is meant to end in a global government in the hands of the right people. But they couldn't do that any farther with Bush's brand of, quote, conservatism. So they had to get in a liberal, quote, professor. But the balls, the chutzpah of the bank bailout, you know. Look, I used to be a pretty shrewd student of economics. I mean, I went to the inside books, and the key to capitalism was created by a Princeton economics professor, well known to the inside circle. His name was Joseph Schumpeter. Schumpeter created the expression creative destruction, and he said the lifeblood of capitalism is letting businesses that can't cut it go belly up and turning all their employees out on the cruel market where they act as a brake on the wages of other people, etc., etc. Well, when Lockheed came along, that was 30 years ago, that was creative destruction applied. When Chrysler went belly up, they're still in business, aren't they? And, of course, Goldman Sachs, and, I mean, good God, too big to fail. Have you heard that expression?
Oh, of course, like with AIG and these.
That's a purely socialist statement as you can conceive of.
Sure, and they're using it.
The key to capitalism is letting them go belly up, absorbing the turmoil that follows, and then reconstructing the market stronger and more efficient. We can't do that. Bush wouldn't allow that done, and neither will Mr. Obama allow that done. They're puppets. They're figureheads. There
of
is
course.
No power in the presidency, and there's no difference who you elect. They've all been vetted throughout their lives. None of them are unsafe. I was kind of praying, and it doesn't matter which side of this spectrum you are, I was kind of praying that Obama would appoint to his cabinet Noam Chomsky from MIT, Ralph Nader. I could name a few others, but you see, change you can believe in. I mean, and once again, whether your readers agree or not, it's immaterial here. I'm not trying to be right or wrong. I'm trying to say that to be consistent with the change you can believe in candidacy, one that turned out the young in just unbelievable numbers, they won't be back, I can tell you that. The appointees were the same old tired turtles that had run the economy into the sewer. And we'll never get out. There is no way to build the economy in such a way that apart from the entitlements, you can actually pay back these loans. They can't be paid back. You can run a 20-30% inflation for a few years and repudiate the loans, which I certainly expect to happen. But otherwise, we're owned lock, stock, and barrel by China, by Malaysia, by Japan, by India.
Ah. I agree with you. All right, well, since we're on that subject, let's get into socialism, communism, and let's not forget Fabian socialism.
Well, the Fabians were the big players in this. The Fabians were all dedicated Darwinists. So as Katie Muggeridge writes in the biography of who was that Fabian lady who's buried in Westminster Abbey? Come on, I'm counting on you here now. My old.
You know, I'm not sure on that. I'm sorry.
Well, she was the lady who wrote the labor legislation for Britain. She created the British welfare state.
Here, let me see here.
On his deathbed, the great classically conservative philosopher Herbert Spencer turned out to be the uncle of this lady, the head of the Fabian Socialists, and they sat together as he was dying, and both of them agreed that they were working to the same Darwinian end. According to Spencer, the people should be killed by working them to death. And according to Beatrice Webb, That's it. Beatrice Webb. You can Google her and there'll probably be a million pages. According to Beatrice Webb, she was for killing them with kindness. So she'd, you know, take care of their old age, take care of their children. Because she said over time that removing these functions of self-preservation would make their lives meaningless. And their birth rate would begin to decline or continue to decline because we would have made them so selfish that they wouldn't want the trouble and expense of children. I mean, once again, it's such a sophisticated hall of mirrors that unless you're willing to pay some dues and read into the primary sources, you know, it's very unlikely that someone could get a map.
Primary sources, for instance, people should read Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope.
Oh, yes. My goodness. But just be sure that you don't get one of the editions that has selectively edited Quigley in order to remove some of the things that are breathtaking. For example, that the First World War and the Second World War were staged.
Oh, yeah.
And Hitler knew it was staged. That's why he let the British escape at Dunkirk. He wanted to signal that he was in on the thing, and he wanted to be dealt in on. It was the first major thrust, the First World War was, toward a global government. And the idea was that the so-called democracies, U.S., Britain, you know, they would support any aggressive nation in the world that was marauding over its neighbor's territory. Because that would break down the traditions and the the independence of a lot of little countries. And then, at the right moment, you would denounce the person you had supported and wipe them out, put them in their place, and that this would be a kind of efficient way to get to the point where people's independent governance had been broken to the degree they didn't care. They just wanted a meal on the table and a roof over their head. At that point, it would drop like a fruit from the tree. So there are editions of Quigley out there that have had it. I mean, he had to be super brilliant. He was Clinton's advisor at Georgetown. That's how I found out about him. New York Times printed Clinton's acceptance speech for the Democratic nomination, and the very last two or three sentences say, "And I want to pay tribute to Dr. Carol Quigley at Georgetown, who understands the world better than anyone else." Well, you know, I'm an addictive reader, and I have been since I've been five. I never heard of this guy. I said, geez, that's weird. I went to the public library, and there was one card file catalog for Quigley, Tragedy and Hope. Only, unfortunately, about the fifth time I went to get it, librarian said it's been stolen from the collection. But I fly all over the country constantly, so I was in Dallas a few days later. I went to the Dallas Public Library. Yeah, it was there. It had been stolen from the collection. San Francisco, yeah, it was there. It had been stolen from the collection. And it was only a couple more before I said, someone is removing this book. This, by the way, is a very common thing for texts that have the power to transform the way you see the world. It's very, very common. They're allowed to stay on the shelves for a year or so, and then they're quietly removed everywhere. So anyway, so Quigley, there are a lot of good editions. They were all pirated, of course. I learned of this from a doctor which I'm sure you could call. He's in Santa Cruz or Santa Clara in your state, and his name is a radio show. Dr. Stan Monteith, M-O-N-T-E-I-T-H. I'm sure if you Googled him, if he's still alive. And he had reprinted the original edition, illicitly, of course, but I bought one from him for $50. I was grateful to him to my dying day. I mean, it's 1,400 pages of not only the truth, but the truth written by a master of English prose. So it's a delight to read, and crackles with ideas. Like, he'll throw away on half a page, and he's doing the whole history of Europe for thousands of years, until mainly it's on the last two centuries. But he would say, in a little sidebar essay, that the only nations that have ever enjoyed a brief period of liberty are the nations where the ordinary citizens have the same quality of weaponry as the government does. He says you get these unusual freshets of liberty in that time, but they don't last very long, as you would discover if
right.
you tried to, you know, buy an F-18 or...
Let me ask you, what is the correlation between the male prison population and the male number in the military?
All right. In Prussia, I'll have two facts to deliver. In Prussia, a formula was worked out in the early 19th century because the problem of governance is to retain the privileged position and not be overthrown. So you have to provide a certain percentage of the population with privilege and another much larger percentage with a job and a reliable income. So they worked out a formula where if 1% of the population was permanently jailed, and then it'd be a larger number prospectively, potentially being jailed, that would maintain a court system, you know, all the rest, and 1% were permanently in the army, you know, whether you were being menaced or not, that this would be the beginning. The formula extended beyond that. But I do believe if you add up our three services today, it's 1.5% in the permanent military. And if you track that back to World War II, we have followed the Prussian model on that. But now get ready for the prison part. About 10, 15 years ago, since we have an economy that operates by creating bubbles and inflating those bubbles and then jumping off with a lot of loot and letting the population, you know, pay the price for the bubbles. So, you know, just give me a second here because at my age, and we've been talking for 2 hours and 15 minutes, I think, the prison population became a corporate enterprise in the United States. If I say 15 years ago, maybe it was 20, but there was talk about it before it happened that this would be a way to provide a steady occupation, not only for prison guards and wardens, but the people who supplied prisons, the people who wrote textbooks about criminology, the college professors. There's a whole nice little package. Now get ready for the bombshell. 6 times as many people in a percentage sense, are in jail in the United States as are in jail in mainland China. It's six times likelier as an American that you're going to end up in jail than it is in China. That sort of puts a new perspective on things, doesn't it?
It really does.
I mean, that awful repressive government, which they are. I mean, they're a hideous.
Well, you know, here in this country, you know, 60% of the people are in jail for nonviolent drug offenses like smoking a joint.
Right, yes. Well, but so the prison industry is an important part of our economy, just as it was in Prussia, except I do believe now it's many times larger.
The governors,
whoever they are, always have this problem that when unemployment reaches a certain point, although now they're reinterpreting, they used to say 5%. And I'm afraid my battery's going on me. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
I think my battery is going on me. That's what that beep is.
Okay.
We'll have to take this up another time, but do send me a copy of this, please.
Okay, when do you think we'll be able to finish up?
Well, how about tomorrow night, same time?
Tomorrow night, same time. All right, you got it.
Some mad bugger's wall.